From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. As the U.S. Supreme Court wraps up its annual break, a scholar with the Libertarian Cato Institute analyzes the High Court's work from the past year. He recently visited Raleigh to offer his assessment. State lawmakers are facing court orders to redraw state election maps. You'll hear what some members of the public think about the process. The controversial chemical Gen X is attracting attention from Governor Roy Cooper and the General Assembly. You'll hear highlights from a recent public meeting on the issue. And we'll explain why one proposal to boost telemedicine in North Carolina might not be as good as it sounds. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
When you live in North Carolina, hurricanes are an unpleasant fact of life. Aside from the obvious concerns over personal safety and property damage, we're also occasionally subjected to shortages, things like gas, ice, and other things. Now, in the wake of a natural disaster, some government officials decide to intervene to prevent what they call price gouging. Our next guest says these folks need to resist that temptation. He's here to explain why. Dr. Roy Cordato is senior economist for the John Locke Foundation. He's been writing about this issue at johnlocke.org. Roy, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Donna.
In the wake of Hurricane Harvey, which of course hit Texas and Louisiana, Governor Roy Cooper asked his attorney general, Josh Stein, to investigate gas stations and incidents of what he called price gouging. First of all, what is that price gouging?
I don't know. You will have to ask the governor. There is no economic definition of that. I've looked through all the major economic textbooks. It's not even in the index. It has no legitimate economic meaning. It's some price that politicians think is too high. The fact is that nobody can charge higher than the market price. The price that brings together supply and demand. That changes at different times, and it changes during natural disasters.
But there is a state law about
there is gouging. Law, and if you read it, it's very vague as to what it is. You know, it's kind of like pornography. They know it when they see it. There really is no rigorous definition, and it's probably different in different states why a price would be gouging in one state and not in another. I think North Carolina, outside of Texas, certainly in the region, is the only state that declared its price gouging law in the last few weeks.
In the law, the phrase is kind of interesting. It talks about abnormal market disruption.
Right.
Now, in the case of Hurricane Harvey, the abnormal disruption would be the pipelines, the gas pipelines.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So is that the subjectivity in the situation?
Well, what you want is, in an abnormal market disruption, is the price system to react to it. That's the beauty of prices. They move to accommodate abnormal market disruptions, right? And when you don't allow that to happen, you get shortages. Best example is OPEC in the 1970s when they embargoed the United States. That was an abnormal market disruption. There were big price controls on gasoline and oil that Nixon had put in place at that point in time. We had huge gas lines. We get gasoline lines and other shortages in the state when there are abnormal market disruptions because of the price gouging laws. What they do is they prevent prices from rising to what economists call equilibrate the market, meaning supply and demand match. And what happens is that people flock to gas stations. Demand goes up, price should go up. And that's what happens, but it doesn't. So go ahead.
Roy, here's the thing about that I think is interesting. It's kind of counterintuitive because let's say we're in the middle of trying to recover from a major storm. So we want gas in our cars, so we go to the pump and the price is higher. Now we're all self-interested, so we want to pay as cheap a price as possible and not have to fork over more money than we would like to. But are you saying that in order to make sure there's enough supply that we should want the price to go up?
Yes. The economists like to say the best cure for high prices is high prices. And what it means is look, what you want to happen is you want people to conserve in those situations, and you want suppliers to produce more or to bring more to the market. If you allow the price to go up, it encourages both of those things. Higher price discourages people from hoarding. What we really need to be protected from the greed of our fellow consumers during this period. What happens? People go out. And if they have three cars, they go out and fill out all three cars, right? They fill the tanks. Why? I don't know. The car's going to sit there during the hurricane anyway, but they do. Instead of that gas being in the tanks at the gas stations, they're in people's garage. It's in people's garages. And higher prices discourage that. The higher the price, the less likely it is people will purchase more gasoline than they expect to need. On the other hand, higher prices encourage more supply. It incentivizes people to bring in more supply from out of state, not just gasoline, but you know, whether it's bottled water or ice or whatever the case may be. A high price and higher profits will encourage people to truck in ice, or they will, or to truck in bottled water, or those kinds of things.
Which is something they might not do if there wasn't enough profit.
That's exactly right. Transportation costs and so on. The higher price encourages that sort of thing. So what you have at the higher prices during these time periods is the right thing happening. You have the prices discouraging unnecessary consumption. Or purchases, not even consumption, and encouraging more supply because of the higher profits that it brings.
There's a couple of classic examples of this, and I'd like you to explain one. Mm-hmm. It was written by our good friend Dr. Mike Munger of Duke University, where he talks about, I believe it was in the wake of Hurricane Fran.
Yes, it was.
The classic example of the truck full of ice.
Right.
But the ice was priced high, much higher than what you would typically on a regular day with no storm have to pay for a container of ice. But people didn't want to pay that. And take the story from there.
The funny thing is they did want to pay it. They were waiting in line to get it. What happened was is that some people from young people from Goldsboro decided, hey, we could rent some trucks, refrigerated trucks, fill them up with bags of ice. I think they brought 500 bags of ice over to downtown Raleigh where they couldn't get any ice, and they sold it. Now they sold it. They were asking $11 a bag for that ice, and people were lining up to get it. So they were willing to pay that amount. The cops came along and shut them down, took their ice, actually allowed it all to melt. The point is, and people were ended up with no ice. So the question here isn't ice at $11 a bag or at $2 a bag. It's ice at $11 a bag or no ice. And what that high price did was incentivize these people. And what would have happened is other people would have caught on and said, hey, you know, we can get $11 a bag. Well, as more ice comes in, the price goes down. Right. And then people conserve at $11 a bag. They're not going to buy as much ice as they would at $2 a bag. But the point is that it really to those people, what if those bags of ice were saving $200 worth of food? That's a good deal. Who's ripping off who here? I'm not quite sure.
That is a good deal. But the interesting thing, Roy, is that in that example and in others as well, the person charging the higher price for the product is considered a gouger.
Yes, they were considered a gouger. I would consider them a hero, right? They went to all this trouble, brought all this ice from Goldsboro, which where they could get it cheaply. They brought it here. They offered it to people. People could say no, right? I mean, they can say no. There's no ice, or there's ice at $11. Say no. If no one's forcing anyone, the only force that entered the picture was the cops who came in and forced these guys to shut down and prevented themselves. Now, interestingly enough, a lot of people cheered when these guys got hauled off in handcuffs.
So some people clapped as the ice was driven away.
That's
but then
right.
when they turned around, they had no ice.
No ice, exactly.
So, you can read all about the issue of economics and the so-called price gouging laws written by Dr. Roy Cordato at johnlock.org. Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. U.S. Supreme Court justices might be enjoying a break in the action, but this is one of the busiest times of year for our next guest. He spends the time in between Supreme Court terms analyzing rulings from the previous year and looking ahead to the big cases likely to be decided in the next year. Ilya Shapiro is a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute and editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be back.
The biggest change in the Supreme Court in that past year was in personnel. Tell us about the impact of new Associate Justice Neil Gorsuch.
Right. This term was kind of lower key in terms of the cases decided, precisely because the absence of that ninth seat after Justice Scalia's passing and the delay in confirming Gorsuch or filling that seat meant that the court took lower profile cases and fewer of them, and we'll get into that. But Gorsuch himself, he participated in 17 cases this term. Remarkably, he agreed with Justice Thomas on every one. We'll see how long that continues. So far, he's what people expected, whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, but a stylish writer, a textualist. His first question on the bench was, why shouldn't we just follow the plain meaning of the text? I mean, it's mind-blowing stuff here, but that theme continued in various writings, and he jumped right in. New justices, typically their first majority opinion that's assigned is a unanimous one, and this was the same case here, kind of a forgettable technical case. But Justice Gorsuch took the opportunity to write separately more than a dozen times beyond that. And indeed, he wrote separately more than in June alone, more than Justice Kagan did in her first two terms on the bench.
Wow. In addition to having Neil Gorsuch now on the bench, what were some of the other big cases from your vantage point?
Well, we're in North Carolina. I might as well start off with Packingham versus North Carolina, a First Amendment case which asked whether sex offenders still maintain their First Amendment rights. Sex offenders are an interesting class of felons. After they've served their time or, you know, paid their dues, served their probation and whatever else, there are still certain restrictions on them. They can't live within a certain distance of schools and other places where minors congregate, et cetera, et cetera. They have to register. Well, in the digital age, states have tried to figure out how to apply those kind of restrictions online. So, you know, you can't go on Nickelodeon's website or interact with kids in various other ways. North Carolina actually had a much broader, kind of an outlier sort of restrictions for online access. And the way that the law was written, not only could you, you know, not seek out the kids to talk to or what have you, but the way it was the law was written, it would bar you from accessing not only things like Facebook, say, or Instagram, but potentially the New York Times website or WebMD or YouTube, because those are sites where you create a profile and can interact with people in the comments. And under North Carolina statute, that was prohibited. So long story short, the Supreme Court unanimously struck down that North Carolina law, not because states can't restrict sex offenders online, but because they have to tailor it. And indeed, sex offenders do have First Amendment rights.
That, of course, a big deal here in North Carolina since it's our own law. Other big cases that were on your mind?
Well, staying in North Carolina, there's the redistricting case, Cooper. These redistricting cases are really weird. You kind of apply the Goldilocks standard when race comes to bear. You can't use race too much, but it turns out you can't use race too little with the Voting Rights Act. In this case, North Carolina has to go back to the drawing board for one district, not the whole board, but it's really, you know, not a kind of a groundbreaking ruling or standard, but I don't know. At a certain point, the court's just going to have to throw up its hands and say, you know, we can't police this anymore. At present, it really depends on how Justice Kennedy feels on any given day. And indeed, next term, we're going to see potentially something revolutionary when it takes up a case involving a Wisconsin map about partisan gerrymandering. No allegations of racial impropriety, but can you use a party designation too much? And both Republicans and Democrats do this when they take control or a supermajority or what have you. Of a legislator try to gain partisan advantage. It'll all come down to Justice Kennedy again, and I imagine that this will be a fizzle because there really aren't any manageable standards to apply in those kinds of cases.
We are chatting with Ilya Shapiro. He is a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute, also editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review, which is one of the reasons why he's looking very carefully at all of these cases. As you are analyzing everything that the court did during the past term, are there some trends that you noticed?
Well, not really. I mean, in general, every year Supreme Court reporters try to come up with some sort of theme for the term. Oh, it turned to the left. It turned to the right. The court's libertarian moment. That was my favorite a few years ago. But it's not like the justices, when they're on summer break, decide collectively or individually, let's move to the right this term. Oh, let's move to – or even Justice Kennedy. He's not saying, oh, I was too liberal this term. I need to be – no. It's just the – it's a function of the amalgam of cases that's on their docket. Now, the court does pick its own docket, so if it feels that the administrative agencies are going way too out of whack, either to the left or to the right, and they need to slap them down, well, you know, that will result in a certain set of results in a certain way. This term in particular, the cases were lower key. There were fewer of them. In history, this is the lowest production of opinions after argument, 62. So they're doing a very good job of putting themselves out of business. It's a great job if you can get it. You know, you have the smartest lawyers, young lawyers in America working for you. You get your summers off to go to Europe and you only produce 62 opinions. I mean, it's great. The trend is a return to the status quo from before Scalia's death. So we had this weird interregnum of eight justices where many cases were decided much more narrowly than they otherwise would be. Many cases simply weren't taken because the court wanted to avoid having those ungainly 4-4 splits that don't decide anything. We're waiting really for the next vacancy, because if whenever Justice Kennedy decides to retire, we could see a telegraph from Salzburg any moment now. Or a year from now, or when Justice Ginsburg departs the court, if it's Trump or another Republican president who makes that replacement, then the court will shift to the right, and Chief Justice Roberts will be the swing vote, as it were.
I was going to ask you about the fact that we had the dog that didn't bark, and that was that no justice decided to retire, which obviously means we're going to have the same court coming back next time unless something bizarre happens. As the court does prepare to come back, what are some big cases that will be on its docket for the next term?
Well, we're going to go back to to what we've been expecting the last few years, which is essentially a blockbuster term of the century. I think this is going to be our seventh one this decade, something like that. A number of big cases. I mentioned the gerrymandering, the political gerrymandering out of Wisconsin. The biggest criminal law case involves cell phone site location information. That is, when you're walking around, all of us have these phones in our pockets and they're pinging off towers. That information, that data, you know, not who you talk to or any of your text messages or what have you, but where you are is recorded by Verizon or T-Mobile or whoever you use. Do the police need a warrant to get at that information? Traditionally, if you're analyzing it like, well, you throw away garbage or, you know, speak loudly and people can overhear you, that's all up for grabs in the public. But it's called the third-party doctrine because you're giving this information to the third party, to your provider. But, you know, is there an expectation of privacy, or have you taken certain steps? Is there encryption? All of these sorts of issues, will the police need a warrant? The court treads lightly in these tech cases, but this could be groundbreaking.
Well, one of the people who's going to be watching very closely to see if that result takes place and to see what happens with the rest of the court's term is Ilya Shapiro, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute and Editor-in-Chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue. More visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read. A new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. No, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal. We hold government accountable to you.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers have heard contrasting arguments about the best way to draw congressional and legislative election maps. During a recent public hearing, Mike Jennings invoked the Bible.
Before Congress adopted the Constitution, the Voting Rights Act, there was the golden rule. I believe the criteria will create an open process and promote fairness in elections. I think that would be consistent with the golden rule. I know in the past others have drawn districts to favor them. I agree, and that was wrong. It's time to turn the corner. Let's do the right thing. Let's do it. Let's treat others as you would have them treat you. I encourage you to be allowed to be touched by the better angels of your nature.
Small business owner Richard Green offered some ideas.
What I've learned as being a small businessman is innovation and progress is dependent on competition and listening to what's going on around you. The business world is full of large, very powerful companies that have failed, named Kodak, Xerox, who failed to follow that lesson. The same is true in government. So I urge you to adopt a districting process that is nonpartisan in nature, that is based on geography, and doesn't deal with any demographic information of any measure. I believe this is critical to our legislative process. It is critical to the progress of our communities, and it is critical to our democracy.
State Republican Party Executive Director Dallas Woodhouse challenged the idea of drawing districts specifically to favor Democrats.
We think the Goldilocks standard of using race, we have to use a little bit of race, but not too much race, ought to go away, and that no racial considerations ought to be made. Now, we also think the use or discussion of statewide election data is completely irrelevant, even though it is largely favorable to the North Carolina Republican Party that has won an overwhelming amount of the statewide election races in the past 6 years. We do not elect people on a system of parliament like they do in Europe. It is not the job of this committee to make a political party that lost 76 North Carolina counties in the presidential election competitive, because they are uncompetitive in vast swaths, vast areas of the state.
You've been listening to a sampling of public comments about electoral redistricting in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation. We're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Residents of southeastern North Carolina are raising questions about Gen X, a chemical that's been deposited into the Cape Fear River for decades. Governor Roy Cooper asked state lawmakers for an extra $2.6 million to address the issue. Legislators decided to convene a meeting of the Environmental Review Commission in Wilmington. Republican Senator Michael Lee was first to address the group.
When we first found out about it, our first reaction was, did this cause the problems that our youngest child has, anatomical abnormalities at birth that cause them to have brain surgery, spine surgery, stomach surgery, throat surgery, being hearing impaired, having to take medication every morning and every night, having a shot every single night for the next 10 years with human growth hormones? That was our first response. Was that grounded in logic or rational thought or steeped in scientific research? It wasn't. I mean, it was emotional. It was an emotional response. And you're going to see that from a lot of people that are here. It's very, very personal.
Lee wants to do more than study the problem.
The administration's request came down, and respectfully, I understand studies, epidemiology, and all that, but it's been 37 years. I mean, we need an action plan today, and I think that's what people in this area, in this Cape Fear watershed, drinking the water every day, they want an action plan.
Not everyone is on board with Senator Mike Lee's idea. Democratic Representative Deb Butler raised concerns.
Our governor, Roy Cooper, has made a reasonable and thoughtful request of this North Carolina General Assembly for money to pay for more scientists, toxicologists, and chemists at the Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Health and Human Services. Those are our watchdogs for keeping our water clean. I know it comes as no surprise to most of you that those agencies have had to fire in excess of 70 staff members since 2013 due to budget cuts. and now they simply need more manpower to do the necessary testing and to enforce the permits to prevent would-be polluters from discharging harmful chemicals into our water.
Republican Representative Holly Grange responded.
This is not a political issue to me. To me, this is a public health issue. And there are still many questions that need to be answered, and that's the purpose of this commission, is to answer those questions. We need to find out what processes failed that so that this situation would occur here in Wilmington and who knows where else in the state. So I thank you for coming here to address this. What is foremost in my mind is that we all citizens, deserve clean drinking water that is free of all contaminants.
New Hanover County Commission Chairman Woody White offered his own assessment of the Gen X controversy.
I thought about the two miscarriages my wife had before our oldest son was born. And that's what all these people back here have been thinking about with their children and their grandchildren. We haven't, at that moment in time, considered science or logic or who's at fault. You know, who was asleep at the switch? What should have been done? What's the statutory scheme or regulatory process that's the best? I wasn't thinking about that. I don't know what happened, who did what. I know somebody put something in the river that didn't belong there. And somebody in the state should have prevented it and didn't. I don't know if he or she was a Republican or Democrat. I don't know if it was a man or a woman or a consortium of all the above. And I don't care.
White recounted his meeting with officials from the company responsible for Gen X.
When the mayor and I and our respective bodies asked for Chemours to come here and we met across that hallway, they did that. I don't know why in the world they did it or who their counsel was, who their lawyer was. I wonder if they still work for them. Because they came here, we found out that Ted and his family and his children and grandchildren and my family, my children, and a lot of the other people have been drinking this stuff for 37 years. We didn't know that. They told us. The state didn't tell us. There wasn't a website we could go to. There wasn't a permit we could look at. I don't care what it's called. What I do know is that its predecessor chemical poisoned tens of thousands of people in Ohio and West Virginia, and DuPont paid hundreds of millions of dollars after 17 years, finally admitting that they poisoned people willfully, intentionally. We didn't know that on June 15th. They told us about Gen X. Now, what if they had decided, you know what, we're going to get good legal counsel here, and politely, we're going to decline the request to come down there and meet with the mayor and the commissioner there. We're just not going to say anything. We wouldn't know that sitting here today. DEQ couldn't have told us that. DHHS probably couldn't tell us that. For decades, nobody's told us that. So I hope that you all will not get sucked into the inside the beltway mentality of playing politics with this. I see why both sides would be tempted to do that. There's plenty of blame somewhere. I don't know where it lies. I think evidence at some point during the enforcement process and the oversight process needs to answer those questions. Why did Sappho and White and their guys and gals have to figure this out for 37 years? Why didn't the state do it? So those are good questions. And in future enforcement actions and oversight functions, we have to know those answers. But this process has exposed systemic and unimaginable regulatory failures at the federal and the state level. And we have an incredible opportunity as a community and as a state, because this is a North Carolina issue. We have an opportunity here to set aside whatever arguments we might have on other issues and agree on what everybody else agrees to. We want safe drinking water. We don't want people to pollute it. And if you pollute it, you're going to get punished. And we got to have an enforcement mechanism that ensures the people that the water's safe.
Wilmington Mayor Bill Sappho offered state lawmakers additional information.
Safe drinking water is what we want. Bottom line, we want the water to be clean that we're pulling out of the Cape Fear and delivering to the citizens of this region. What I have personally found in this whole process is the federal laws, state laws, the federal agencies overseeing this, state agencies seeing this, and sometimes them not talking to each other, or if they're talking to each other, the regulatory process at the federal level is different from the regulatory process possibly at the state level. And Woody's right. We have an opportunity here to get it right and make it a bipartisan issue, because this is a public health issue for not only the citizens in this region but throughout the state of North Carolina. Because one thing I have found out is compounds and chemicals are in every river in the state of North Carolina. The citizens of this great state should be given that information to know at least what is in their drinking water.
You've been listening to some of the testimony from the State Environmental Review Commission's recent meeting in Wilmington. The topic, what to do about the controversial chemical Gen X. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Technology is revolutionizing how we access and how we deliver medical care, but some medical professionals are reluctant to embrace what's called telemedicine because some of those services are not covered by insurance. Now, it's an issue that the state of North Carolina is now looking into, and that has gotten the attention of Catherine Restrepo. She is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Healthcare Policy. She's here to tell us why she's just a little bit concerned about that. Catherine, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about what it is that the General Assembly mm-hmm. has directed the state's Health and Human Services Agency to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, on October 1st, the Department of Health and Human Services, they're supposed to submit a policy recommendation report to the legislature looking at telemedicine and all the advancements that all the telemedicine initiatives that are happening in surrounding states and whether or not those states have parity laws. And that's really the main issue we're talking about here. And so essentially a parity law is the question of should the government force insurance companies to cover telemedicine benefits and all the health plans that they sell to policyholders. And the idea is that if it forces insurance companies to cover these benefits, then more doctors, more providers, more hospitals will use telemedicine and implement other telemedicine initiatives hospital-wide for more policyholders, because this is a way to be a more cost-effective method of healthcare delivery.
Let's remind our listeners what telemedicine really is. Give us the example.
Sure. Basically, telemedicine is just delivering healthcare at a distance, and it can be done through all these different modalities, through a tablet, through a computer, through a telephone. I mean, doctors have been doing telemedicine since the late 1800s when the telephone was invented to diagnose patients over the phone, saving them from having to go to the patient's home to do a diagnosis. So telemedicine is really advanced, especially in the past couple of decades. It's this booming industry. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry, and a lot of payers are playing catch-up as to whether they're covering these benefits in their plans.
Catherine, in the piece that you've written about this, which folks can read at johnlocke.org, you note that a number of states, in fact, a lot of them, mm-hmm. more than 30 states, actually
yes.
have these laws that require an insurance company to cover telemedicine in the benefits package.
Right. 32 states do so far.
But North Carolina does mm-hmm. not have a parity law.
Yes, we don't. And there is no need for one because the market has been working to I mean, hospitals, providers, again, are using telemedicine on their own without parity laws to expand access to patient care. I mean, North Carolina, there are many rural areas in North Carolina, and hospitals, health systems, and providers are aware of this, and so that's why they're embracing telemedicine.
Help us understand a little bit more about how it is that telemedicine could be growing and could really be helping a lot of people, mm-hmm. and you mentioned in rural areas most prominently, but without that requirement. Because all those states have that requirement and North Carolina doesn't. So mm-hmm. some folks might be scratching their heads and saying, well, hey, wait a second, that doesn't make sense.
Right. Well, I think it's a false notion to think that if a state doesn't have a parity law, it's behind the times on telemedicine. And that's simply not true. I mean, if you look at North Carolina, there's so many things that are happening with telemedicine across all spectrums of care, from primary care to specialty care. Looking at Carolina's healthcare system, for example, they have this tele-ICU program where they have this command center staffed with intensivists and specialists outside of Charlotte and Mint Hill. And it's like these providers are an extra set of eyes and ears. They connect, through computer monitors in rural hospitals with ICU units that are short-staffed with intensivists and other specialists as well. So it's a way where patients in rural areas that are affiliated with Carolina's healthcare system don't have to be transported to a main hub or a main flagship hospital. They can be cared for closer to home, and it saves hospitals money. It saves them on readmissions penalties because they're just closely monitoring their patients, but it's all at a distance.
That has so many different benefits that I can think of. I mean, number one, a lot of times I think traditional thinking has been, well, if you, quote, live near a really good medical facility, mm-hmm. you've got it made if you get sick. And if you don't live near something, then
right.
you may be in trouble.
Yes, it addresses that whole rural-urban divide issue in healthcare and equitable access to healthcare, and telemedicine is really helping fill those gaps.
And one can only imagine, too, how much more convenient that makes it for the patient who doesn't have to worry about transportation
yes.
when they're using this kind of, mm-hmm. of technology. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about phones here, right? I mean, you can actually text doctors mm-hmm. or
yeah,
you can do this on your laptop and they can actually see and explain things to you?
Yes, yes. At the primary care level, there's a lot of texting going on. There's a lot of virtual visits between a physician and a patient through a laptop or a tablet or their own phone. And there's many apps, they're called mobile apps out there for telehealth services that are HIPAA secure, HIPAA compliant, meaning that they comply by patient privacy laws. And it's just an easier way and much more cost effective for patients to get access to basic healthcare needs. For example, RelyMD, that's a healthcare app that's homegrown in North Carolina. A group of emergency physicians created it, and patients can access a licensed physician practicing in North Carolina through RelyMD for $50 out of pocket. And that's compared to traveling. I mean, so much more cost effective, because compare that to traveling up to 30 miles or more if patients in more of a rural area to go to their primary care physician office and pay, you know, if they're paying cash out of pocket, that could be $150. So there's some serious savings that can happen too.
We hear so much, Catherine, about folks who have concerns about access to care.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned the rural-urban situation, but one would think that those who have those concerns must be looking at telemedicine and direct primary care and saying, this is just opening up so many opportunities
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
such greater access for people, kind of levels the playing field, so to speak.
Oh, absolutely. And the great thing is that, you know, we don't have a parity law, but providers are still noticing how telemedicine, I mean, there's this shift from fee-for-service medicine to value-based contracts. In other words, doctors and hospitals are paid a prepaid package to care for patients within a defined budget or within that defined amount of payment. And they're including telemedicine as a benefit within that healthcare package. And it's paying dividends for many people.
Now, the General Assembly has been looking at different things around the subject of healthcare innovation
mm-hmm.
and medical care providers and all that. And they actually made some progress that you wrote about in your piece at johnlock.org having to do with nurses being able to deliver care through telemedicine.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Governor Cooper, he just signed off not too long ago, last month, I believe, on legislation that would, it's basically updating this multi-study license reciprocity that nurses have, so they can practice, they can see patients in other living in other states, nurses that are licensed here in North Carolina. But that also includes the fact that they can deliver telemedicine services to patients in other states as well. So that goes again back to the access issue and removing these barriers to licensure, removing these barriers to care, can really help extend the reach of care to more patients through telemedicine.
Do other providers in the medical field face similar obstacles in being able to deliver care this way?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's currently what's going on with the Federation of State Medical Boards. There's this interstate medical licensure compact that doctors are now signing on to. So I think 17 to 19 states have signed on to this compact, and it's still in the works as far as the operations and how it's going to play out. But it's very similar to the nurse licensure compact, where doctors can practice in multiple states, gain licensure in multiple states, and see patients living in those states.
Well, it's a really fascinating piece about this innovative technology that really is expanding access to medical care. It is called telemedicine, and Catherine Restrepo has been writing about it at johnlock.org. Her latest piece headlined, "Don't Force Insurance Companies to Pay for Telemedicine Services." And as she's explained, North Carolina does not have what's called a parity law, and Catherine says it doesn't need to have one either. Catherine, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.